The sculptor and painter Henri Matisse said the job of the artist is to turn himself inside out before he dies. On this edition of Conversations, we'll talk with an artist who has taken that admonition seriously. Please welcome poet Toy Derricotte. Toy, welcome and thank you.
Thank you so much.
Can you elaborate? I think we probably know what that means on the surface, but when Matisse said the job of the artist is to turn himself inside out before he dies, what does that mean to you when you sit down to write?
Well, I think it means opening yourself to discovering what it means to be human and constantly finding new material, new themes, things about yourself that at first you may not want to look at, not want to explore. And I think if you believe that what's underneath ties us all together as human beings, then really no matter what you find, it's a way of validating human experience. So you keep turning things up and finding a way to take what is buried and change it into art.
Some part of the skeleton that is you is in me as well. That's what you...
I wonder if I think of it as skeleton. I guess for me it becomes skeleton when you find a form for it. And so as it becomes a real work of art, it takes on that kind of reality for me. Mm-hmm. But there's so much between consciousness and unconsciousness that is of great interest to me. What is almost forgotten, what is intentionally forgotten. You know, like certain times our parents, our grandparents won't talk about certain things.
Right.
So trying to find a way to bring those things to the surface is interesting to me.
Is there something deeper and wider about the things that the consciousness doesn't want to bring up than about the things that float easily in consciousness?
Deeper and wider, meaning more.
Is there something that pulls you towards the thing that won't be remembered rather than the thing that will be remembered? Or pulls you through the thing that will be remembered to that other part?
I was thinking about what attracts an artist to not even material, but a certain kind of energy that stays consistent, and so that over and above the content of the work or even the themes of the work, there's a kind of a passion that artists have that is recognizably the kind of mind inside the poem or the kind of energy inside the poem and or the work of art. And I think that's really what we like about artists or dislike about artists. I mean, many, many artists are, wonderful at what they do. But I think there's a certain kind of, it's like love maybe, falling in love. Like certain people we love. Uh-huh. And so I think one of the things that I do, and I don't know whether people can relate to this or not, and really it's not my business to worry about that. But one of the things that I do is try to go across boundaries. I'm driven to go across boundaries. Boundaries you're not supposed to go across. And I can remember when I was very young that there were neighborhood boundaries. And your parents, there were lines around neighborhoods and there were streets. And your parents would tell you, don't cross Ryan Road. You know, you'll get hit by a car. I mean, there were these practical reasons for you not to go across Ryan Road, but really, it was something else. There was a reason you weren't supposed to go across Ryan Road that was not just about the cars. There was something on the other side of Ryan Road that you weren't supposed to go to.
Had something to do with those people and our people,
yeah,
or what we
exactly
want you to be.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And needless to say, as soon as I could, I was going across Ryan Road. And that just happened in lots of ways in my life. Mm-hmm. And it keeps happening.
This is Toy Derricott with us on this edition of Conversations. We're taking a look at her poetry because she's a poet and her point of view as an artist that brings her to the kind of poetry she writes. Her most recent book is called Captivity. Toy Derricott with us on this edition of Conversations. We've got lots of things to read. And of course, this takes us into it, this huge empty place when I ask you, is there something that you'd like to read to us to start? There's poems in captivity.
Well, it's interesting, the word captivity, isn't it? In reference to the same subject that we were talking about.
Yes.
And so I do find myself looking at this tension between being held and a drive to escape or go someplace else. And the word captivity, I think I was thinking not only of the word to be captive or captured, but also to be captivated by something, to be held, enthralled. Mm-hmm. So that meaning is there also. Well, let's see. This book was a new exploration for me because this is the first book, this is my third book, and this is the first time I wrote about issues of race, class, and color in my work. The other two books really don't deal heavily with those subjects. And I think the reason why is that artistically, there's a danger in beginning to write about certain subjects because our literature in the past has been presented as aesthetically bound, as if there is one kind of aesthetic that should bind our literature together, and there's a kind of universal language and universal experience that exists. And I think my first two books, I was kind of wisely wary about going over into a kind of material which, again, might put me in a captive position, being held in a space and recognized in a certain way that would not let me kind of escape it. And that does happen when people begin to write about certain topics and certain subjects, and certainly often women's issues, often issues about race or class, they sort of become put in a category. And so on the one hand, where I feel very driven to explore these issues, on the other hand, I am somewhat circumspect about getting in those categories.
Amy Tan says that she's reviewed in a cluster, almost inevitably, of Asian writers.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
What she says is it cuts her readers off from acknowledging this huge experience she thinks she brings as a writer.
Well, you know, I mean, Matisse's statement, the job of the artist is to turn himself or herself inside out. Yes, absolutely, but in some way that puts a big burden on the writer of color in terms of being comprehensible, because frequently as soon as you begin to talk about these subjects, your reader gets a kind of a fear, a dis-ease, a feeling almost that maybe you are purposefully excluding that person.
You as an artist.
You as an artist.
Yeah.
And of course, this is not true. You're using the material that you have to get to the deeper things. And in a way, for all artists, all experience is metaphor. I mean, you're using what you have to uncover the deep human experiences of life, death, birth, mm-hmm. loneliness, love, whatever. And that's your material. But it's true that the whole question about the universal has put us in, as reader and writer, in positions that are that hold some tension, and that does have to be worked out, and it will have to be worked out, of course, in our country as we change, mm-hmm. As literature begins to hold more voices, we will have to change.
And do you think that this I'm wondering how you think this change will happen. Do you think that, like water dripping on the rock will eventually change its shape as writers bring the African American experience into the universal, or women's experience into the universal, mm-hmm. slowly that aesthetic will
I think open what's going to happen, I'll tell you, I think one of the ways it's going to happen is remarkable miracles are going to happen. For example, we heard a lot in the last generation about the anger between black women and black men. Remember, this was a big thing in the 60s and the 70s, and how was this going to be resolved? And black women were very angry, and black men were demanding that black women, put down their own feminist concerns and get behind the men. And, you know, the reason was quite understandable, in that there was a fear that turned out to be a right fear, that empowering women would be that a lot of white women would get powers that black people were still excluded from. And this has happened, unfortunately. We've seen that we would love to think that all white women and black women have had the same concerns and have fought together and have empowered each other and been sisters together. But unfortunately, right. a lot of times black women have been excluded from the concerns of white women. And I think black men were saying, you know, okay, you're abandoning us, you're abandoning our issues. And sort of black women were caught in a bind, because mm-hmm. they wanted and needed to be empowered. But they were also responsible to hold together the race, as women always are responsible for holding together civilization, for cooking the food, for doing the rituals, for to bringing together the social life. And so there was this great conflict. But I've seen something amazing happen in this generation. These young writers that I've seen, these young black writers that men that I've seen, are so compassionate. Compassion is always the way that things truly go into revolution. In other words, when these young black men are writing about their mothers and their sisters with such love and tenderness, understanding these conflicts rather than saying, choose me or them, this kind of impossible dilemma, really. They're looking at these women and they're seeing their burdens, and in their writing, you just see a new way of bringing things together. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what has to happen. I think farther than this anxiety, than this anger, this sense of exclusion, that sometimes readers will express, that they feel excluded, they feel, you know, they don't understand this. Eventually, there's got to be a way in which they can take this in. They become large enough to take in what was before something to make them angry, and to see it in a larger sense. This is what has to happen. I think it can happen. I don't know exactly when and what the complicated process is.
It's not always true, but one of the things you're talking about is how the separated self, the person who is excluded from the group, sees more about the group and is able to
absolutely.
Yeah. Doesn't always happen.
It will. I think it has to, because the fact is that when you don't have power, when you have to get along with people, when you're dependent, I mean, this is what double consciousness is all about. Mm-hmm. That you have to, and women understand this, I think, well, that when you have to get along with people, you begin to think like them, and you begin to move into their mm-hmm. mind. And that is why, for example, when a person says to me, I never see color, I don't think about race, you know, you say, oh, well, isn't that fortunate? Aren't you lucky? You know, because a lot of people have to think about it from the time they're just like 2 years old. Mm-hmm. They have to think about it all their lives, and it's a great burden to have to think about it all the time, but you do. And even now for me, talking about this here, you know, it's a subject that I'm not anxious to talk about, again, because I don't want to get typecast, because once you get over there, it's hard to get out. But at the same time, it's a boundary that I feel the need to go over. I feel the need to understand something about human experience that I wouldn't understand unless I began to talk about this. Mm-hmm. But also, you see, my color and the way I look brings about another kind of interesting phenomenon also.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You've talked in the craft talk that you gave while you were in Fairbanks about light skin being as much of a block as a door opening, that in some ways it holds you back from some parts of color culture and lets you into some parts of culture.
Well, everybody it turns out that in a society where there's truly systems mm-hmm. that, you know, or organized kinds of ways in which people are excluded, and you know, I mean, we just the you know, looking at the way some recent statistics have talked about bank loans going, you know, you can have the same amount of money, the same education, be in the same neighborhood, and if you're black, your likelihood of getting a loan is different. I mean, there are all kinds of ways this is codifiable, but I think that internally, what I say is we're all wounded by racism, but for some of us, the wounds are anesthetized, and I think that we like anesthetization. Everybody likes it.
Uh-huh. Don't wake me up.
Yeah, I mean, who wants to not have privilege? Nobody. So again, that's part of the tension, you know, whether you want to feel it or not. Maybe I'll read this from this one here, because I think this might explain some of this that I'm trying to talk about now. Early memory, the California Zephyr. I'm sure most people don't go around all the time thinking about what race they are. When you look like what you are, your external mirrors reflect back to you an identity that you take for granted. However, because I don't look black, for me, those mirrors are broken, and my lack of consciousness takes on serious implications. Am I not conscious of my blackness because, like everybody else, I'm just thinking of other things? Or is it because I don't want to be conscious? Am I mentally passing? In fact, in situations where I'm not only conscious of being black, but speak of it, I am taken to be white. Because of this, I see things people recognizable as black don't see. Often the occurrence is subtle, more sensed than provable, like the mildest breeze, and other black people present, perhaps without the same basis for comparison, may seem unaware. I'm very interested in that word passing, mm-hmm. because we're talking about the phenomena of passing between things. And that's an interesting word, how that came about, passing. All my life, I have passed invisibly into the white world, and all my life, I have felt that moment of consciousness there, of remembering I am black. That moment of consciousness may feel like emerging too quickly from deep in the ocean, or touching an electric fence, or like a deer stuck in the headlights of an oncoming car. Sometimes in conversation with a white person who doesn't know I'm black, suddenly a feeling comes over me, a precursor, though nothing has been said at all about race. And I either wait helplessly for the other shoe to drop, try desperately to veer the conversation in another direction, or prepare myself for a confrontation. I think the first time I became conscious of this internal state was when I was in 15, on my way across country on a train, the California Zephyr. The first day out, a young white man sat in the seat beside me. We had had a very pleasant conversation, but at night, when I grew tired, I asked him if he would go back to his seat so that I could stretch out. He said, "If you saw what's sitting in the seat beside me, you'd know why I can't go back." Of course, I knew without looking back what he meant. And as I stood up and turned around to see, I felt that now familiar combination of sickening emotions. Hope that my sense of the situation was incorrect, in effect preferring to distrust my own perceptions, and fear that it wasn't. If I remained silent, I would feel like a coward and a betrayer of my people. If I spoke, I would be vulnerable. At the very least, he may categorize me in the same way he had categorized the person sitting beside him. I turned around, and sure enough, there was a young black man, a soldier, sitting in the seat. I said very softly, "If you don't want to sit next to him, you don't want to sit next to me." I had hoped he'd be too stupid or deaf to understand, but he grew very quiet and said after a few minutes, in an even softer voice than mine, "You're kidding." "No," I said. "You're kidding," he said. "No," I said. "You're kidding." Each time he said it, he grew quieter. He excused himself and must have found another seat. He may have slept in the bathroom, for every other seat was taken. And when I looked back to see if he was sleeping beside the soldier, he wasn't. The next morning, he found me on the way to breakfast and profusely apologized. "Please let me buy you breakfast," he said. I was lonely and wanted company, but I felt I had to punish him, make him pay. I thought punishment was the only way he would gain respect for black people. And I felt the most effective kind of punishment was not verbal confrontation, which I was convinced would only confirm his stereotypes of hostile blacks, but cool withdrawal. In effect, my response put me in a position in which I had to punish myself too, for I didn't want the pain of loneliness and alienation. I wanted and needed a friend on this first trip. But I felt in order to cut myself off from him, I had to also cut off my feelings of tenderness and trust. The last night on board, just before we were to arrive, I looked back and saw him sleeping beside the soldier. Perhaps he had gotten sick of sleeping in the bathroom, or perhaps my suffering had done some good.
This is an essay from the Black Notebooks?
Yes.
Are you going to publish these?
Yeah. Well, some of them have already been published. That one hasn't, but some of the ones about children and about living in an upper-class, all-white neighborhood, some of those sections have been published. Mainly what I wanted to do was look at my own feelings about being a black person and why this terror suddenly at a moment when I realize I'm black and a fear comes on me. I mean, that's pretty remarkable. What is that about? And also, there's a great shame in that, as if something is wrong with me. Why should I feel that?
There's this phrase we throw around, internalized racism.
Absolutely.
Internalized homophobia. Absolutely. Internalized misogyny.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Anti-Semitism.
Do we all throw those terms? Those are great terms.
But it seemed to me when I was thinking about internalized racism that all of those have some place in this world, not just this culture, but in this world.
Absolutely. And in the world, and as I said, as going back to the Matisse comment, you see, these are metaphors too. I mean, unfortunately, the very structures that hold us together as a society and create mm-hmm. devastating kinds of realities are also about very human, I think, internal mechanisms, maybe even normal kinds of mm-hmm. mechanisms that are very painful to look at. And I don't understand it all myself, but that's what I'm trying to find. I'm trying to find some of the things inside that aren't so easy to name racism or this or that, but you know, why do things get put into categories? What are we so afraid of? What are we mm-hmm. not able to accept in ourselves, and we end up projecting onto other people? You know, these are the bad people. That's across Ryan Road. Right. That's not us.
Yeah,
I'm very interested in that.
Toy Derricotte on this edition of Conversations. The book most recent is called Captivity. The press for Captivity is the University of Pittsburgh Press. Captivity first came out in 1989, its second printing in 91, third printing in 1993. The first two books that Toy talked about, the one before this one, Natural Birth, you'll find that from Crossing Press, and earlier, The Empress of the Death House, forgive me, Empress mm-hmm. of the Death House from Lotus Press.
Yeah.
Toy Derricotte on this edition of Conversations. She also read a piece of prose. I understand you've been writing on the Black Notebooks, in the Black Notebooks for 15, 20 years now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, I hate to admit such a thing.
On this edition, we're taking a look at the poetry and the perspective of Toy Derricotte.
Yeah.
Tell me what you think about what happens when we say, I don't feel the effects of misogyny or of racism. That didn't bother me what that man did. It's okay. What happens when we swallow it, push it aside?
Well, you know, one of the things that I found out is there are just no simple answers. You know, people do things at certain times in their personal lives, mm-hmm. in their family lives, in the history, in the evolution. You know, people do things for complex reasons, and we can't judge things in yes, no, black, white terms. And that's what it means to really speak with another human being and to get below the surface of experience, which, mm-hmm. you know, we learn these rules and we learn these stories about ourselves and what we're supposed to do, what we're not supposed to do, what we're not supposed to talk about, what we can talk about, what we can say. And in some way, we are then held captive in these really not alive ways of being. I mean, for example, mm-hmm. if my parents, my mother and father, did not want to talk about what happened to them in the South, you know, I don't want to talk about. Well, I could say they're in denial. I could say, you know, they didn't educate me. They didn't. But you have to understand the great drive for acculturation for.
Yeah.
I mean, even color stuff. I mean, people have said a lot about how people who are light-skinned, black people, have privileges. I think it's true. I mean, color certainly in our society is, you know, the Andrew Hacker story. He wrote this book, Two Nations Separate, Hostile and Unequal, a wonderful book. But one of the things he did is he did an experiment in the colleges where he asked young college students, all right, everything about you stays the same, but we're going to make your skin black. You have the same income, you have the blah, blah. What do we have to give you for, in terms of money, to make this worth your while? So the answer is $1 million a year for the rest of my life.
Oh, to make it worth it to have darker skin.
Exactly. Whew. For white students.
It's very telling.
It's very telling because we do see skin. And we do know the we do know what in our society it means to be dark. We would rather not, and there's some ideal that, you know, it's almost like you think, well, if I say I don't see it, then I'm okay or something. But, you know, we all know what it means in our society. But so in a complex world like that, there are all kinds of ways people have to deal. And so sometimes they don't talk about it, sometimes they bury it, sometimes they pretend they're not bothered, they're strong, they're tough. And I think we have to appreciate the complexity.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, I thought you'd talk to me about consequences, but you're talking to me about how reality is just, why do I think of the word thickened, made broader, deeper?
And I love it. I love it because there's a woman that I'm working with now, and I don't want to divulge her identity because I don't think that's right, but she is working on a story, and she started out by seeing me as a black woman that she felt intimidated by. And we begin to talk about that. Mm-hmm. And then she remembered a girl from her childhood, a black girl that she had felt intimidated by. Mm-hmm. And then we begin to talk about that. And then she began to remember when she came to school, her parents, because of their own values, had sort of put in her a part that felt weak. And so that when she came, she was in a way looking for that match to her personality, an intimidator. Uh-huh. And because in our society, you see, the black person is a bad one, sometimes we find what we're looking for in that place. We go looking in that place in a way, unconsciously. And she began to write, and it opened up to very wonderful and complex understandings about a teacher, a white teacher who was the first person who validated her and told her, you're smart, you're great. But this white teacher also told her, that black girl, she shouldn't go on to high school. She'll never be a secretary. She'll never make it. But who did her allegiance have to be to? Because that was the first woman who validated her. So here she is aware of this moment in time when she sees that the woman that she admires so much is not without some pretty serious problems. But she has to kind of bury that.
Right.
And so that's the kind of subtle stuff that I think really makes us see this as a living.
I almost see a football player racing down the field, dodging implications. You know,
it's alive.
Yeah.
It's alive.
Yeah.
And these are the kinds of ways that I think we begin to accept that it's not the bad guys against the good, the bad person against the good person. It's understanding the complex web that we're all implicated in, a part of, and to begin to see, oh, it's this big thing that's, this is the way it's touching us, and to see ourselves in a way, being honest with each other too, because one of the things that we have to realize is, as again, people with privilege have been allowed to become anesthetized. And there's a lot of things that anesthetization has cut off from them, certain understandings that it'll take a long time for them to really be aware of.
Mm-hmm. This is Toy Derricotte with us on Conversation. She's an associate professor of English at the University of Pittsburgh. Her latest book, also from the University of Pittsburgh. She's read some prose for us in this portion of the hour, and we'll look for some poetry as we also move along. This is a funny question, but how did it occur to you how rich this vein was that you have decided to mine in your life? This is, you write about issues that relate to women, issues that relate to race, issues that relate to men. I should just say to gender as well as to race. Issues that relate to the what we think of as the fraught emotions, pain and shame and anger. This is not something you'll move out of and, quote, write about something else in your life, I think.
I think it's some perception about the harm that's done when some parts of our emotional life die. I wrote a poem in my first book called Unburying the Bird, and it was about going down and finding that bird that had been buried was alive. And, you know, you fed it and it finally it flew away. And years after I wrote that poem, I remembered when I was 3 years old actually burying a bird. And that sense...
Little girl with a shoebox in the backyard?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, in some part of my brain, that bird stayed there until I wrote that poem 20 years later, waiting for me to transform what was hidden, buried, and to give it a new life. And so I hadn't realized that when I wrote that. I remember, too, when I was I was writing since the time I was about 10. And my cousin Melvin was in medical school at the time, and I admired him, you know, and so he was taking a course in embryology, and he was in Chicago, and so he took me to the Museum of Natural History, where they have the fetuses, embryos, all the way from conception to birth. And you know, I was like 14 years old. Nobody had ever talked to me about these things, and I was really impressed. And I said, "Oh well, Melvin would be the one to really for me to show my poems to, because I wasn't showing anybody." And so that I said, "He's going to appreciate what's hidden and buried and mysterious."
Because he has all these true things in front of him, right?
Yeah, and he's showing me these things, you know. And so I showed him my poems. He said, "These are really sick." You know, these are really hard. And the point was that I was not writing about the things that made you, what, happy to hear about or something? I mean, one of the burdens that kids have is they're supposed to be happy, because then if they're happy, their parents think, or their friends or their relatives think that they've done a good job and they're being good parents. Mm-hmm. And it's a heck of a burden for kids. And that's why I love to teach poetry to kids, you know, fourth graders, fifth graders, because there's so much of this powerful questioning about life and observation that can come out in creative work that sometimes can't come out in our relations with the people we love the most, because they don't want us to be disturbed. They don't want us to be unhappy. But that's just a part of experience.
It's an interesting thought that people don't want children or the people they love to be unhappy, because that's a reflection on themselves.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And parents worry, you know, if their children are talking about dead birds. Some parents, not all parents, of course. But so in that situation with Melvin, either I could stop writing. Or
Melvin's right.
Yeah. Or I could write about what Melvin, I mean, I would kind of know what he would want me to write about. Or I could go hide some more.
You went and hid some more.
I went and hid some more.
Yeah. You write autobiography in many ways. I mean, not strictly, but in many ways. Does that give you a place to stand on the planet?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
That's a good way of putting it. I think for people who are defined by society in ways that disempower them, that take away their uniqueness, you know, because they are in some category of other, you know, the stereotypes that are attached to being a person who is black in our society. You know, you are whatever, ignorant, whatever the stereotypes in terms of your own soul, even, it goes that deep. You're a beast, you know? You're not alive, you're not, I mean, that's from the slavery, that you're an animal. That's the way that you can own somebody and not feel guilty and do terrible things to them. They're not alive, you deaden them. Mm-hmm. Okay, so here you are, this person, a part of you understanding in your consciousness that in this society, you are dead meat. You don't exist. You are invisible. You are not recognized. You are just a body. You could be an athlete, you know. All right, a dancer.
Model.
A model.
Yeah.
Your body, your flesh, your meat. You're a slave, you know. Okay, now, how do you carve out a mind and a soul that makes you unique, that gives you uniqueness, individuality, beauty, and sacredness even? Sacredness, you see. You have to invent this. Mm-hmm. You have to invent your own life. And you have to sort of take the mirrors that have been put there, you know, that your society is reflecting back to you. You are a mammy, you know, the images of the black woman who takes care of white people, whatever these mirrors are, that are the mirrors we get stuck in, and which part of us believes in our own minds, because of course you do, you internalize, as you say. And then you have to find other mirrors, invent other mirrors in which you can see yourselves as sacred and powerful.
It's very nice to talk about it as the mirror. Mm-hmm. We do see ourselves as others describe us to be.
Right.
I want to ask you a question about the canon, and not just the great canon of literature, but the written word that we see all around us. I have kind of two questions at once, and one is, what is it for a writer seeing herself as a writer in a culture that doesn't have a long Western culture, long tradition of recognizing and celebrating artists of color? And the second part of that is, do you see that changing with the diversification of the canon, the willingness of...
Can I use one of these to read?
Oh, please, sure.
It's a short one. But I want to talk about the subtleties when we think of these big things like canon.
Right.
Because that's, to me, where the most interesting issues lie. Okay. This is called baby pictures. I'm again working in the schools with fourth graders, teaching them poetry. Mm-hmm. And I go to a different school every week, so I have 100 new kids every week. So here I am the second day with these kids, fourth graders. I'm out in the suburbs, and this is what happens. I had asked the fourth graders to bring in baby pictures. We were going to play a game. Guess which picture belonged to which fourth grader, talk about being a baby, and write. Sounds fun, right?
Mm-hmm.
That morning, as the children mixed their pictures in a pile, the face of the only black girl in the room came at me with new clarity. I sensed this game might put her in danger. The children fumbled over several pictures, guessing Tracy, Sharon. When I held up Deborah's picture, they didn't hesitate. "That's Deborah," they said in unison. Deborah looked shocked. How did they guess me so fast? She looked hurt, as if she had been discovered in a good hiding place. How did they know it was me? Either the children didn't consciously know, or else they were ashamed to say. One girl said, "You can tell by her brother standing next to her." I thought of the way Deborah sits in the last seat, in the last row, as far back as possible. Still, she sticks out like a sore thumb. "That's Deborah," they had all said in unison. Her face fell in disbelief. She came up to look at the picture, Trying to discern what gave her away, she held it up, turning it, talking to herself. But how did they know that was my brother? Yeah. So, you know, she's thinking to herself, okay, her brother doesn't look the same then as he looks now either. So why would they recognize that as her? I mean, that didn't answer her question. So then, of course, this brings up a whole lot of stuff. And one of the questions is, of course, how does an adult in that situation deal with this kind of thing? What do you do?
What did you do?
Right. Mm-hmm. Because I was in that school 4 days. And how do I know the complicated things that are going on in that classroom? How do I know what's going on with Deborah? And did she know at one time and now she doesn't know why she's recognizable? Is it better for her not to be thinking about this stuff right now because she has to think about other things? You know, again, when we recognize the power of this thing that we live in, we can't expect individuals to be shining examples of some ideal, mm-hmm. because there is no ideal. We're all trying to make it the best way we can. And I don't mean there isn't any ideal. I have my ideals of people who are committed to, you know, really making change. I want to be one of those people. But all I'm saying is for me to say to this little girl, well, you know, Deborah,
you're black, silly.
You're black, and, you know, why are you responding this way? You know, or children, other children in the class, what did you mean? What, you know, maybe that would have been appropriate. But I think for us to be tender and try to understand people rather than to think we can quickly make it all snap right in some kind of way. Mm-hmm. I think that's more interesting. And what this has to do with our literature is to make room for these things that we don't understand. You know, Toni Morrison talks about lots of things she's talking about that are so wonderful lately. But she talks about how our American literature isn't complete until all the stories are there. And she also talks about the need for the canon, the white writers as they exist right now. For some strange reason, we have pretended like they weren't mm-hmm. touched by the racial climate of our American society. I mean, it's crazy, but for us to begin to even look at the literature that we've read in the past and that we know very well and to begin to understand why Moby Dick, the great white whale, why was Melville so interested in holding up this as a symbol? Why was it written at the time it was written in? What did it have anything to do with slavery in our society? You see, these are the things that we haven't talked about. There is a great deal of texture that's already in our literature that we haven't even talked about. And once we begin to acknowledge the way we've been touched by this great force and stop pretending we didn't notice, I think we can begin to make some very interesting networks mm-hmm. that begin to pull our literature together. But I think one of the things that's so important is to empower people that don't know how to begin to speak about their experience because they're ashamed of it. And
you talked about a little girl, high school girl. Your assignment was, again, you were participating, I think, as a poet in the schools, and your assignment was to the students to write about what they saw outside their window.
Mm-hmm.
And she wouldn't do it.
Right.
And she wouldn't do it because she didn't want to write about pimps and prostitutes and
that's right.
pee-stained mattresses.
Right, because it means that something's wrong with you.
Right. If I have to look out on that then
mm-hmm.
I'm
and,
somehow.
And again, that's another thing we have to think about. How do people have to defend themselves psychically against some kind of self annihilation of worth, self-worth, ego? I mean, you know, when you see kids, you talk about kids, oh, they're walking around in $100 sneakers, you know, they could be using that for something else. I know that, you know, everybody has different values, but I also know that, again, there are all kinds of reasons why people do things to just survive as your ego, with your ego intact.
Mm-hmm.
And how powerful a drive this is when a lot of forces are very destructive mm-hmm. against the sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
But writing is so powerful, you see, because a lot of these people who have been marginalized is a very common word, but in some way they feel their experience is not valuable. Okay, I look out of my window and I don't see
A tree growing in Brooklyn.
I see pimps and prostitutes.
Right.
Oh, well that means that I don't live in a good place. That means my house is not good. That means I'm not good. That means my parents aren't good. Oh, well, I'm not going to talk about that.
I have nothing to write about.
Well, no, it's worse than that. I'm ashamed. I'm the person that goes to school in my $100 sneakers, and I always am clean.
Uh-huh.
So why am I going to write about looking out of my window and seeing a pee-stained mattress? Because people don't know me that way. They know me as someone who's always dressed well. How do they know where I live?
Mm-hmm.
They don't. So I'm not going to begin to tell them now.
And as a teacher, you say to that student?
Just like with Deborah, I would never presume to know the way for anybody. But I would say, when that person does tell me that, I would say, you know, I'm really moved by what you've done. Because very interestingly, you see, and the kids have to catch on to this, what they've hidden is their power.
Mm.
That's their power. The hidden has a kind of energy inside it, just like that little bird that I hid, that I buried. Somewhere it sticks back somewhere, and a part of you knows that it's to come forth in a different way.
This is coming full circle, Matisse, again.
Yes, this is the creative act, the human creative act. And when the child begins to see that, okay, it looks ugly the first time you look at it, but there, you have other eyes, there are other mirrors. And also, to be empowered to speak and to move another human being is transformational.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great power for young people, and boy, have I seen it change people's lives. Young people, powerful.
Emerging out through their own words, as if listening to themselves allows them to grow into more of themselves?
As if suddenly being aware of, I think, I don't know. I can't answer that. I'm thinking of a little fourth grader, Maritza Hoyas, who came over to this country. She learned how to speak by watching TV. Learned how to speak English by watching TV. Her parents didn't know. She's from Colombia. And when she was 9 years old, she wrote this poem, Blind Hands. Like two blind birds that don't know you, my hands come up upon the earth. Into the dark they will find you. Grow to the sun, shine through the moon. Go far. Blind hands, I'll wait for you.
Mm.
She's nine. I think what it is you discover your language.
Mm-hmm.
You discover the invisible that's really your power. I mean, the sneakers are okay, but mm-hmm. to have a language that you discover that is so beautiful. In some way we know when, you know, that language comes. We know we begin to understand the beauty of it and the power. And I think you can't take that away from somebody. That's why you could put her, you know, someplace totally alone, and she could still have access to that. And that's pretty strong. It's pretty strong. Feels good.
Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you.
Toy Derricotte, on this edition of Conversations, I commend you to these books, Captivity from the University of Pittsburgh Press, Natural Birth, and The Empress of the Death House. Anything coming?
Well, I hope the Black Notebooks, and I'm doing a new book of poems, too. Good. Dark Fortunes.
Dark Fortunes and mm-hmm. Black Notebooks. Goodness.
I know.
Right. Well, thanks. Toy Derricotte, the recipient of many honors and awards, two fellowships from the NEA, one from the United Black Artists for a distinguished pioneering of the arts, these in just the last couple of years, and others from the state of Maryland, Maryland State Arts Council. She's a recipient of the Pushcart Prize for Poetry and the like. Three good books, two coming up. Look for them. Toy, I want to thank you for a fascinating hour.
Thank you.
Hour.
Very
it's been
nice.
A lot of fun.
Oh, thank you. Enjoyed it.
I'm Susan McGinnis. It's been a pleasure to have you with us. I hope you'll join me again next week.